This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. And here at the People Speak, we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Radio live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8:55 p.m. to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our website, thepeoplespeakradio.com. There you can also hear live shows or listen to our past shows on the iPod Ready Archive section. The People Speak is a live one-hour radio show that reaches people all over the U.S., Canada, and Australia, and even as far away as the U.K. Our audience can call in by phone and speak to me or my guests by dialing 1-415-762-1160 or by calling 1-712-432-0075 and entering the access code 318116 and followed by a pound sign. We're also excited to announce that you can now listen to our show via your smartphone. So there's no excuse to hear the most fascinating people right here on the People Speak Radio. Tonight's guest is Hedy Epstein. Hedy was born in Germany. Her parents, unfortunately, although there is no clear indication of what happened to them, were believed lost in the Holocaust. And Hedy is not only a Holocaust survivor and speaker, but she also is an advocate of ending the occupation in the Palestinian by the Israeli government. It is my pleasure to talk to you, Hedy. How are you this evening?
I'm fine, Basma. Nice to hear your voice.
Well, it's a real pleasure. I know Hedy and I have at least one mutual friend, Yusuf Bedekat. Yusuf was one of the individuals that was allowed into the Gaza territories. But before we get to that, there's a lot of interesting things, Hedy, that I'd like to discuss with you. You being a Holocaust survivor and your family's not, can you tell me a little bit about just help our audience understand what happened to you and your family and how you came to do what you do today.
Okay. I was born in Germany, and when Hitler came to power in 1933, I was 8 years old. And my parents very quickly realized that they needed to leave Germany because to raise a family under the Nazi regime was not a good idea. And they were willing to go anywhere in the world just to get out. And their efforts to get out, you know, became increasingly more desperate. But there was one country they were not willing to go to, and that was Palestine, because they had some really serious reservations about what was happening at that time in Palestine. And probably some fears about what might happen in the future. I was fortunate in that I was able to leave Germany on a children's transport or a kinder transport in May 1939, and I went to England. England took in almost 10,000, mostly Jewish children from Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia, in the 9 months preceding World War II, and would have taken more except the war broke out. And I was placed with a foster family, and I remained in written contact with my parents until England declared war on Germany in September of 1939. And then you could only stay in touch by sending 25-word messages through the Red Cross. And then in October of 1940, all the Jews from the area where I come from, southwest Germany, were deported to a camp in what was then Vichy, France. France had already been occupied by the Nazis, but the southern part of France sort of seceded from the rest of France and called itself Vichy, France, and collaborated with the Nazis. And there were many, there were several camps in Vichy, France, along the border between Spain and France. And men and women were separated by barbed wire. Was perhaps an aberration of the war because my parents could now correspond with me directly, but they were allowed to write only one page per person per week. I could write as much and as often as I wanted to. In March of 1941, my father was moved to another camp. In July of 42, my mother was moved to still another camp, all of them in Vichy, France. And then in the summer of 1942, both my parents, as well as other family members who were also in these camps in Vichy, France, were sent to Auschwitz and have never been heard from again. And so they either perished on the way to Auschwitz or in Auschwitz, probably, were, if they did survive the trip, they probably were sent straight to the gas chambers because they were had already been almost 2 years in camps in Vichy, France, and probably were physically not in very good condition.
Now, Hedy, let me ask you something. A lot of people... not a lot, but not, certainly not enough, but a lot of people survived the concentration camps. But you did more. You went on to work with, in the confines of the Nuremberg trials. You were actually there. You made sure that you were part of what was going on. Can you tell us a little bit about the Nuremberg trials and
yes.
how it came to be that were there?
Well, first there was the international trial of the Nazi big shots conducted by the United States, Great Britain, the former Soviet Union, and France. And after that trial was over, then the American government decided to conduct 12 more trials in the same Palace of Justice where the international trial took place. And the very first of those 12 trials was the trial of the Nazi doctors who performed medical experiments on concentration camp inmates. And I was assigned to that trial. And my job was to look for the documentary evidence that the prosecution was going to be using. And so most of my time, or a good part of my time, I actually was not in Nuremberg, but rather in Berlin, where there was a former Nazi document center. And that's where I was looking for the documentary evidence. And I was not prepared.
May I ask you, do you think that you were looking for this document, that your initial search for the documentary evidence was because perhaps you were looking for the letters or indication of what happened to your parents?
Well, yes, I was, because, for instance, you know, we came across documents where the Nazis had compiled lists that they were deporting to a particular camp. And so, yes, I would go through those lists to see if I would see my parents' names or other family members' names.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you never did find that evidence,
no.
Did you?
Well, I did. At one time, I found a list, and it was dated January of 1942, and it had my father's name on it. But I still was receiving mail from my father until... he was deported to Auschwitz in August 1942. So I'm not sure whether that list that it made out in January of 42 had anything to do with what happened actually in August of 1942.
And you remember your parents
Oh, yes. I mean, I was 14, I was 14 and a half years old when I left.
And I found that interesting. I mean, on all of my, in all of the things that I've read about you in the last day or so, I have not read that you had mentioned that your parents actually spoke of this, of the Palestinian issue. Can you enlighten me a little bit on and our listeners on what they said about this?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, my parents desperately tried to leave Germany and were willing to go anywhere in the world just to get out. But with one exception, they were not willing to go to Palestine.
Why is that?
Well, my parents were anti-Zionists, and I think that had probably had a lot to do with it. They did not want to displace the people, the Palestinians, that were living in Palestine at that time. And I know there was the Jewish National Fund that was collecting money probably all over the world, but certainly I know they were collecting it in Germany. And with that money, they were buying property in Palestine from Palestinian people and then were placing Jewish people in those homes or on that land. And I think that is something that my parents did not want to be a part of.
And did they say what their problem was with Zionism?
Well, you know, I was still a young child. And, you know, so my parents said they're anti-Zionists. And I didn't totally understand really what that meant. And so I know I remember saying, I'm an anti-Zionist too. You know, without really knowing what that meant. I lived in a village in Germany, and there was a Zionist youth group in the village, and all the Jewish children belonged to it, but not I. My parents did not allow me to be part of that.
Did you feel somehow left out?
Well, in some ways, I felt left out. But on the other hand, you know, I felt comfortable at home and with my parents. And so if they made that decision, then that was okay.
Well, let me ask you, Hetty, this isn't, and I think this is probably an important question. Do you believe that your parents were correct about the issue of Zionism and the Palestinian territories today?
You know, since I didn't really pursue the questions at the time, I can't say they were correct. I mean, I can only guess at it or make assumptions. And yes, if I make an assumption, then I would say they were correct. But I can't say that with certainty because I did not go into depth to explore at the time what my parents really meant.
Well, I can understand that.
And it's not only. I'm sorry.
Oh no, go right ahead.
I said, and then, you know, it's not only in that regard. There were other things where I didn't ask what seem now as obvious questions, but I didn't ask them at the time because you know, children. I guess, you know, they are happy with what may seem like a superficial response. You know, like, for instance, I took some items with me that from home, and I remember this one particular item. It's a fan. And I asked my mother, where did you get that? And she said, for my mother. Well, that was fine. I didn't ask anymore. And the obvious question is, and where did your mother get it from? But I never asked that.
We, as you said, children are easily satisfied, and they're very trusting of their parents, and as they should be. Very interesting. You've been to 5 trips to the Israeli-occupied West Bank, Hetty.
That's right. The first one.
When was your last trip back there?
In 2008, I think. No, 2007. Mm. I'm sorry. In 2007.
Oh, I see. So there was, and what do you recall? What is one of the things, Hetty, that struck you the most interesting, the first and the last trip that you've been there?
Well, you know, the Palestinians are supposed to be my enemies, and the mm-hmm. Israelis are supposed to be my family or my friends. Well, that's not how it was. It was the Palestinians who were concerned about me, who've taken care of me, who've welcomed me into their homes, who've provided me with hospitality, unlike any that I've ever experienced anywhere in the world. And it's the Israelis who were my enemies. It's the Israelis who, for instance, the first time that I left in 2004, at the airport, I was detained for 5 hours. I was strip searched. I was internally searched. I was 79 years old at the time. And a young woman in her early 20s was doing this to me. And when I asked, you know, why are you doing this? She said, because you're a terrorist, because you're a security risk. You know, I'm a terrorist because I visited the Israeli-occupied West Bank, which you're not supposed to do if you're Jewish. I'm a security risk
they didn't boil you in oil and eat you alive in Palestine, you mean?
No. Quite the contrary. I mean, I participated in the 5 times that I was there. I participated in a number of demonstrations, nonviolent demonstrations, against the military and the Israeli government is doing to the Palestinian people. You know, building the wall, demolishing homes, etc. At these demonstrations, there were always Palestinians, peace-loving Israelis, and internationals. And we were always nonviolent. The violence was always on the part of the Israeli soldiers. Live ammunition, tear gas, sound bombs. At one of the demonstrations, a sound bomb, which is very, very loud, went off very close to me, and I lost some of my hearing as a result of it. Many Israelis have lost their hearing because of those sound bombs.
You know, I've never heard of a sound bomb. Honestly, this is the first time
I've ever heard it. You don't want to hear it.
Yeah, I guess not. Hetty, you've also been attacked here in the United States, have you not?
Yes. In June of last year, let me backtrack. I was going to go to Cyprus and board a ship under the auspices of the Free Gaza Movement and go to Gaza. The day before I was to leave from home, I was assaulted on my street in broad daylight. And somebody pushed me with both hands from behind. I didn't hear the person come. The person never said anything. And I lost my balance and fell, and I injured myself. And one of the injuries was I nicked an artery, and so there was a tremendous amount of blood loss, and I was not able to go to Gaza or leave to go to Gaza the next day. I had to cancel that entire trip.
Yeah.
And that was not my first attempt to go to Gaza. That was my second attempt to go to Gaza. Third attempt was in December of last year to go with on the Free Gaza March. Mm-hmm. And the Egyptian government decided after they, I'm sure, got pressure from the Israeli government and the United States government not to let us go. And then there were some negotiations, and they finally decided that 100 of us can go. And we were about 1,400 people from 43 or 44 different countries who were in Egypt hoping to go to Gaza. And Egypt was just a transit point. And then when they said 100 of us can go because they are trustworthy, but the others, the remainder, the 1,300 plus others, are hooligans. And I was amongst the 100 that could have gone, but I felt I could not be complicit with the Egyptian government, the Israeli, and the American government. And they were going to use that as their PR. You know, Egypt is letting 100 people go and say nothing about those 1,300 hooligans. And I thought I chose to be a hooligan.
It's a mess.
And I did not go. But I hope there is now, again, under the auspices of the Free Gaza Movement, there will be a flotilla of boats going to Gaza sometime, probably the end of this month. And I will be on one of those boats. There are going to be, I think, two or three cargo ships and then five ships for passengers, and a total of about 600 people from across the world are going to be aboard these ships. And they're going to be journalists, parliamentarians, trade union people, human rights people.
Teddy, may I ask you something? Are there a lot of Jews that are like you that believe that what is happening? Or is there enough Jews? That's probably not a good question for me. Let me rephrase that. Are there enough Jews in the world and in Israel like you that are willing to stand up and make a difference so that you think that perhaps one day the occupation in Palestine will end?
Our numbers are increasing, especially after what happened last year in Gaza. The massacres that took place were, you know, close to 2,000 people lost their lives and homes and infrastructure. Everything was destroyed by Israel, which were, you know, in violation of human rights laws and international laws. And I think the world, that was sort of a wake-up call for the world. They finally saw or heard what Israel is really up to. And so, yes, our numbers are increasing. But I think what really would make the difference, and would make a difference overnight, if President Obama would say to Mr. Netanyahu, no more money.
Is that likely to happen, Hetty?
Well, I don't know that President Obama has the courage to do that.
I have found very few presidents that have had the courage to stand up to the great state of Israel. And I know, and I know for myself, it has to do with Zionism. And it has to do with the power that the Zionist lobby wields in this country. How are you perceived by your fellow Jews?
Well,
as a survivor that defies the occupation.
You know, some of them are challenging the fact that I'm not a Holocaust survivor, but that's really because they don't want to talk about the issue. So they're challenging because I was not in a camp, because I was not in a ghetto, and I was not. Mm-hmm. That's true. I was fortunate in that respect. But the definition of who's a Holocaust survivor by the Israeli Holocaust Museum, which is called Yad Vashem, by the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., is that anyone who lived under Nazi occupation is a Holocaust survivor.
Well,
and
I certainly
lived under the Nazis, beginning in 1933.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am a Holocaust survivor. But I'm also referred to as being anti-Semitic, as a
self-hating Jew. I know
that's, as a traitor.
I knew that was the next one that you were going to pull up, because that's what we hear about many of our friends that are Jewish.
Right, but I don't really
stand
hate
up for
myself.
The rights of the Palestinians. Hear the same thing all the time, too, that they're self-hating Jews, that and if they weren't, you know, there. We do have a question, and it's very pertinent to this topic. So, if you don't mind, from Alan in Spokane, We get questions all the time from our listeners. And Alan would like to know, the Holocaust spokesman Eli Wiesel is currently being charged as being an outright fraud by Holocaust survivors. What is your opinion of Mr. Wiesel?
I don't know, and I don't really care. You know, but, you know, I guess
everybody's
going to
fight
it.
Their own battle, huh?
I mean, you know, if he was in the camp, as he claims he was, you know, I am sorry that he had that experience. What I'm even more sorry about, though, is that he is not able to make the connection between what happened either to him, if he really was in those camps, and what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. And he seems
and he
to
doesn't.
Have a total... There's total silence on his part. And, you know, and he said, you know, I don't live there, so I can't comment on it. Well, he doesn't live in Darfur, and he certainly comments about what's going on there. He didn't live in Kosovo, and he took a position on that, and he didn't live there. So why can't he take a position on what Israel is doing?
Because
in fact, he was here in St. Louis, In I think it was in December of last year, he spoke at St. Louis University, and we invited him. You know, we spoke up loudly and invited him to come with us to Gaza, because this was just before we were going to leave for Egypt and then Gaza. And his comment was, "I heard you," and then he turned his face in the opposite direction from where we were and took the next question.
Wow. I mean, that in itself, to me, says a whole lot, but I mean, I would be reading a lot into that, certainly. One of the things that I find the most interesting is, I'll be honest with you, you know my good friend Yusuf Barakat, who happened to be our guest last week, and the reason we had Yusuf on the show, Hetty, is because he was one of the 100 that actually entered into Gaza,
right.
And we wanted to hear the truth about what was happening there. So for me, as a Palestinian growing up in America, I have had the most incredible relationship with Jews. The most wonderful people that I know have been Jews just like yourself, who have stood in solidarity with Palestinians throughout my whole history, in my lifetime, and in my activism. Like you and Yusuf are friends, like Yusuf and friends in Israel, where he stayed while he was there, even past the Gaza experience. And yet, I suddenly found a whole new kind of Jew. For some reason, I guess I had in my mind that the mean old evil Jews were kind of like the Nazi images that we pictured. They were some elite force that was only part of the military, and everybody else was wonderful. And yet I find that there are a lot of people that are still very, very hateful of the Palestinians. I look at some of the settlers that are being brought in from all over Europe, Eastern Europe, to build and to live and to flourish in the area of natural growth, as Netanyahu put it. And they're frightening people, Hetty. Where are these people coming from? Who are they?
Well, you know, they're not only from all over Europe, as you said, but not terribly long ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, they went to Peru, you know, in South America, and they picked up some people there, and they gave them some training for about a week or so, how to be Jewish, and then brought them to Israel. See, they're concerned about numbers, and because the Israelis... their birth rate is not as high as the Palestinian birth rate, and so they're afraid that at some point they're going to be more Palestinians than there are Jewish people in Israel, and they're
approaching
that.
It's always been about the numbers.
Right, and so, you know, they're bringing in, gathering in people from wherever they can, and even if they're not Jewish, they're going to make them Jewish and tell them, you're Jewish, you know. And there is also an out-migration from Israel. People are leaving for a variety of reasons. And so, you know, that again affects the number of Jewish people living in Israel. And that's there.
You know, one of the things that I always found interesting, Hetty, I found this to be fascinating. A lot of people would say, well, why did the Palestinians teach their children to throw bombs, and what are they doing there? And I thought to myself, well, they don't really have an option. As you know, many of the Palestinians fled during the initial period of the invasion of Palestine. Are still to this day are refugees in diaspora, and not being accepted by any entity because, really, to be quite honest with you, the majority of the Arab world is just barely surviving on its own, and they can't afford to take on an entire culture of people. So what we have here is a situation where Jews are actually picking themselves up from relatively safe, probably not prosperous, or some of them may have prospered, I don't really know, but relatively safe environments in various countries and moving to a war zone. Now, I've always found that to be a very interesting scenario. You know, we as Palestinians, or at least not myself, but the Palestinians in the territories really didn't have any choice. Where else would 6 million Jews go? I mean, nobody's ever really offered them an invitation into another country. There is no accommodations for the expulsion of the Palestinians. There is no plan for the expulsion of the Palestinians. All we hear is that they have to leave, but nobody's ever accommodated with a plan. And here are Jews that are picking up their families from relatively safe environments, safe countries, or more safe than a war zone, I would imagine, and they're taking them to a war zone to live. And then they're upset that they don't understand why people are dying. Well, it's a war zone. Am I wrong in that, Hetty?
Well, but it's, you see, the propaganda that Israel puts out, and that the American Jewish community, under the auspices of AIPAC, you know, this very strong Jewish lobby, put out that Israel is, you know, this land of milk and honey, and it's a wonderful place. And everybody that comes there who is Jewish immediately becomes an Israeli citizen. And yet Palestinians who live there, who've lived there for generations, you know, they're not recognized as citizens. They cannot, you know, those who fled and their descendants of those who fled in 1948 and 1967 and became refugees, they have no right of return. And, you know, just because I'm Jewish, I have a right to go there. And I've never lived there. None of my family has ever lived there. Why do I have this right?
I was saying your parents didn't even want to live there.
No, right. But I mean, you know, but I'm saying I have that, well, I don't know whether they'd welcome me. They know too much about me. They may not want me. But aside from that, you know, Jewish people can go to Israel and become citizens immediately. But the Palestinians do not have the right of return. And according to United Nations rules, they do have a right to return, but nobody's enforcing that. And, you know, and I think the reason that Israel has been able to get away with some of their evil deeds is because the world is afraid that they might, if you criticize Israel, you're going to be called anti-Semitic. And I'm really puzzled. What is so terrible about being maybe referred to as being anti-Semitic? Anti-Semitic.
I don't think that it means that you hate Jews or that you want evil to be done on them, but But if they are taking an action that is inappropriate, that is illegal,
I mean, you're allowed to criticize any country. You're allowed to, if you live here, you're allowed to criticize the American government and what it's doing. But you're not allowed to criticize Israel. Why is Israel different? And, is it because during World War II, there was a Holocaust and 6 million Jews died or lost their lives as a result of it? Yes, that did happen, and that is a huge tragedy, and it affected me personally.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
That does not give me the right to persecute another people.
Teddy, you have given over 2,000 presentations. May I ask you?
You've been counting.
Many of them are. Oh, really? Wow. And many of them are to schools and to students. Do you talk about this? Do you talk about
yes.
the Palestinian issue?
I mean, when I'm, and I'll say when I'm allowed to. Just very recently, one of the other people that I went to Egypt with, she and I were to talk at the medical school here at one of the universities. And somebody at the university received a call from a Jewish agency here, and they demanded that we not be allowed to speak. And so it was canceled.
Wow.
But that doesn't happen very often. Most of the time I can speak. And
I had an interesting experience. I have a grandson. And, we're very careful not to instill any kind of anger or distrust of just Jewish people in general. But my grandson had an interesting experience. My daughter called me, and she goes, this is your fault, Mom. And I go, what are you talking about? And my grandson had written a booklet, and it was supposed to be like a travel brochure from the country of his origin. Well, my grandson is part half Iraqi and half Palestinian, but his teacher was a Zionist Jewish woman and who spent a majority of her off time in Israel and was very proud of her Israeli citizenship. And she called me up and she started to read me the first few pages, and instead of offering my grandson the opportunity to look on the internet for aspects of the Palestinian history from which he originated from, she said, well, since there's no books in the library on Palestine, you can write about Israel as your history. Now, we were astounded that a teacher, and many people have told us that we should have followed up on it. We didn't at the time because we didn't want to harbor any ill will for the teacher, because it was a wonderful school. And outside of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, even this teacher was a phenomenal teacher. We have no doubt about that. But his first statement was, Shalom from Israel. And here I am as a Palestinian. It's like, my goodness, I told my daughter. I said, what happened to all my teachings? Did he learn nothing? But I found that to be less than, I found that to be disingenuous on the part of the teacher. I felt that she had an obligation to allow him to use, even if there were no books, there was certainly plenty of opportunity for him to use the internet in our time and age and
right.
look up his own heritage. Why would she ask him to, and him, the only child in the school, in the class, to change his heritage to suit her, what I felt was a political need. And I was very disappointed by that.
Well, I think it was in 1969, Golda Meir, who was at that time Prime Minister of Israel, made the following mm-hmm. statement, there are no Palestinians.
Right.
Yes.
And people
This was in 1969?
I think it was 69. I don't know about that particular statement, but the other statement that she made, that if Palestinian mothers loved their children less than they hated Israel, was actually a plagiarized statement, and the original statement was not hers at all, but she is given credit for that statement.
Mm.
And I thought that was funny, too, as I was doing my research. But, you know, it's neither here nor there. Let me ask you, Hetty, will there be peace? Do you think that the good Israelis will stand up to their government and say, hey, the time is now. We have to have peace. You have to do something.
Well, you know, I'm an eternal optimist. And so I feel that someday, hopefully still in my lifetime, that there will be peace, and there will be peace for the Palestinian people and peace for the Israeli people. Israel continues on the road that they're on, they're not only destroying Palestinian people and Palestinian land, but they're destroying their own people and their own land.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine having banks and credit that serve the community, solvent and free of Wall Street corruption, that create strong local economy and job growth? Banks that put profits right back into the local business and economy, not into far-off foreign investments or high-risk and exotic finance schemes of the super-rich.
Yes, we can.
Can you imagine eliminating income tax, ensuring economic stability, increasing social programs, and improving the standard of living for all Americans while paying off the federal debt?
Yes, we can.
That's right. It's all possible.
Yes.
Can you join us in working towards a solution utilizing principles suggested by our founding fathers through united action and strategies outlined in articles, blogs, and Wicca spaces where you can share and collaborate?
Uh-huh.
Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, and help us make America's money and future of, by, and for the people once again. Can you do that?
Yes, we can.
Caution, if you are prone to being disturbed by real truth and real solutions, please continue to consult with your qualified Wall Street cheerleader economists on network television. Side effects for not visiting webofdebt.com include drowsiness, loss of job, loss of control of national finance, loss of country, followed by panic attacks and rude awakenings.
Thank you, everyone. Hello, this is Basma of the People Speak Radio with our guest, Hetty Epstein, Holocaust survivor, speaker, and peace activist, and a pro-Palestinian Holocaust survivor. That almost sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it, Hetty?
Yeah, but it isn't.
It isn't. And thank you that it isn't. Thank you, Hetty, as a Palestinian American. Here, you and people like you have always inspired in us the will to continue to struggle. Not just based on the fact that you are on our side as far as the Palestinian struggle, but if you can endure what happened during the Holocaust, we can endure and continue to fight for justice, not just for ourselves, but for the rest of the world. Holocaust survivors placed an honorarium on justice. They instilled an inspirational aspect of fighting against such horrid crimes. And I think that we as Palestinians, by standing up and defending ourselves, or by at least protesting and in dissent of such crimes, are actually honoring the Holocaust survivors.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But,
well,
you know, I really see the Palestinian people as an amazing people, a very resilient and resourceful people. You know, despite all odds, and the odds are really stacked against them, they still keep on struggling and hoping for a better future for themselves, for their children, and their grandchildren.
Now, having gone to Palestine a number of times in the occupied territories, Hetty, obviously we've always heard that what's happening on the ground and what it translates here to American media is a world apart. What is happening on the ground, Hetty? How can you translate the truth to people that are listening?
Well, you know, all I can say is go there and see for yourself, and it'll be a life-changing experience. But I think the real work, I've come to that conclusion just more recently. I think the real work has to be done here where we live, to change the hearts and minds of people. And, you know, and we can do it by, especially those of us who've been to the West Bank or who've been to Gaza, when we come back, you know, talk about what we've seen and what we've experienced. And I've made that commitment when I first came to the West Bank in 2003. You know, people said to me, you know, the American media doesn't really convey what is happening on the ground. So when you go back to the United States, you know, tell people what you've seen and what you've experienced. And I've tried to honor that commitment by talking with every opportunity that I have, whether this is in schools or universities or at community gatherings, wherever it is. And I think, you know, those of us who perhaps cannot go over there to see for themselves, you know, keep yourself informed, be open-minded, and then speak out.
Absolutely.
Get to know people who are unlike yourself. Get to know Palestinians, you know, for instance.
We're actually pretty nifty keen people, for those of you that don't know. Adopt a Palestinian today. you know, we have a question from Jim in the USA, and although, Hetty, you did touch on this earlier, I would like, he does want to know, where did Hetty go after she left Germany as a teen? Was she treated well, and how did you survive?
Okay, I went to England. I lived in London. I lived with two different foster families until I had to drop out of school when I was 16. To go to work and support myself. And my first job was a live-in job. I was a companion to a 14-year-old little girl, and I was 16. And so we really became like more like playmates. And wow. Later on, I worked in factories that were producing war material, because this was then during World War II.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And were you treated well?
Well, the first foster family I lived with, there was a problem there, and that's why I was then placed with a second foster family where everything was fine. The first foster family told me that I had been starving in Germany, which was not true, and that I need to gradually increase my food intake for health reasons. And my daily diet consisted of a piece of toast and butter and a cup of tea for breakfast, two pieces of toast and butter and a cup of tea for lunch, and two more pieces of toast and butter and a cup of tea for dinner. And that for 6 weeks while I was living with them. So I was trying to supplement my diet by chewing on grass, because I realized, you know, cows chew grass. So maybe there's some nutritional value there. I could never swallow it. I would chew it and then spit it out.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something? Well, now talk about diversity and diet. Well, I'm glad you did survive that. It seems like you have survived an amazing life, Hetty, and congratulations to you. What a heroine you are. And I know that you're a heroine to a lot of people in Palestine. We need people like you. Unfortunately, not enough. We feel that not enough Jews do speak out, but it is growing, and that's the interesting thing.
Well, we need not only Jewish people to speak out. Everybody needs to speak out.
Everybody.
When you see injustice, you know, then speak out. I feel that everybody not only can but must make a difference in life, and it doesn't matter who you are, how old you are, or what your station in life is. Each and every one of us can and must contribute something to making this a better life for everyone, everywhere.
Do you think Americans are misinformed by the media, Hetty, about what's happening in Israel?
No, I mean, the media, it does not really. When you look at the regular media, it doesn't convey what's really happening. You know, if an Israeli child loses its life, and that is very sad, and that shouldn't happen. But when an Israeli child loses his life at the hands of maybe Palestinians, then that becomes big news. But when 10 Palestinian children lose their lives, that's not a news item.
Well, it's
you know,
not, and if
a Palestinian child's life worth less than an Israeli's? I don't think so.
Well, I think the interesting part is not so much that it's not newsworthy, but it is also transformed into something insidious. When a Palestinian child dies, it, somehow it's their fault. They were hiding behind, there was a terrorist hiding behind the children or the mother. Or why did the parents send them out to play when they're in a war zone? Or, you know, it's as if they went out and asked to die. And I find that to be, you know, such an aberration of the truth. It's like, and how
it's blaming
how
the victim.
Exactly. And this is exactly what I've always said. You know, here in the United States, you know, it's like blaming the rape victim for wearing a short skirt. Well, she deserved to get raped because she had a short skirt on. Well, the Palestinian children deserve to die because they play in their streets. And what people don't understand is that this occupation has been going on for 60 years now. So where are the children going to play? When are they going to play? Is there a time that is allowed for them to play that they can't risk being killed? And what do you do after 60 years? Do you stop living? Do you hide and cower in your cellars until another 60 years passes and you may be safe? No, you go on and you live your life in an ordinary way as you possibly can under the circumstances. And children need to go to school. They need to see the sunshine. They need to play. And they need to understand that what is happening is inappropriate. And it's wrong, and it's unjust. And if we don't teach our children that justice is deserved by everyone, well, what else are we going to teach them?
Well, as I said before, you know, the Palestinian people are an amazing people. They're, despite all odds, you know, they keep on, they're resilient, and they keep on living there as best as they can. They raise their children as best as they can, and they do not teach the children to hate. But, you know, what do the children see? In order to go from one place to another, you have to go through an Israeli checkpoint, and they go with their parents, and their parents are being humiliated by young Israeli soldiers. So all they see is soldiers who are humiliating their parents. And what does that teach these children?
I have to tell you, Hetty, the last time I was in Palestine, we were at the Kalandia checkpoint, and I know you're familiar with Kalandia.
I'm familiar.
And we were in a tour bus. Trying to get into Israel as a group of people from Ramallah. And there was this young man, a young soldier from Israel, and he climbed onto the bus, and I swear, Hetty, and they warned us. They said, don't mock them, don't do anything or say anything, because they could very well kill you. It happened all the time. So I didn't want to say anything, but honestly, I didn't feel threatened by it. He looked like a little boy. You could see that he almost had no hair on his face, Hetty. He was pumping his shoulders up because the long rifle, and I don't know what kind of a rifle it was, that the IDF carry, was literally, as he was walking down the bus trying to interrogate us and kind of frighten us, I suppose, was dragging on the floor. And don't get me wrong, this is what, to me, all I saw was a little boy.
Yeah.
But I literally saw Palestinians cowering in the back of the bus. One man.
You know, he can do no wrong. And no matter what he does, you know, his superiors will support him. And,
exactly.
And that's an awful lot of power being given to a young kid. I mean, they become Israeli males when they are 18 years old and graduate from high school. They have to go into the military, mandatory service, for 3 years. And the women or the young women have to go for 2 years. Now, there are some very courageous young Israeli men and women who have refused to go in the military. And then they're put in jail for 30 days. And when the end of the 30 days, they're asked whether they're ready to go into the military. If they're not, 30 more days. And some of them have spent long periods of time in jail. So there are courageous young people that are standing up and saying, no, I will not be part of this.
It is amazing to know that these young people are standing up to such a powerful, omnipotent government.
Right.
And just the ostracization of them within their own communities. But honestly, one of the things that I found, there was a young Israeli reporter that had spoken, and you know St. Mary's Church here in the Livonia area, at one of the Sibyl conferences, and she was a former journalist, and she left Israel because she couldn't handle what she felt was an illegal occupation. And one of the things that she told me, and I found it to be quite interesting, she said a lot of people just don't talk about the occupation in Israel because there really isn't much to say. They know it's wrong, so they just pretend it doesn't exist.
Well, and then there are others who really don't know that it exists because they're not allowed to go to the West Bank, and so they don't go.
About it.
And they don't see it, and they don't know what's happening there.
Exactly, exactly. Well, this has just been an honor having you with us this evening, Hetty. I'm afraid the time has come for us to call it a night. I thank you so much. I appreciate you as a Palestinian. I appreciate you as a citizen of the world. I appreciate you as an American that has stood up and spoken truth. Thank you. I hope to have you
thank
again
you
with
very
us,
much.
Hetty. I wish you all the best. And good luck. Hopefully we'll talk to you after your trip to Gaza.
Right.
I look forward to that. Folks, next week's guest is Professor Wes Tunnell. He's a Texas A&M a biologist and a Gulf Coast ecologist, and he will be discussing the oil spill that has just gone so far unchecked out in the Gulf Coast. So let's keep our fingers crossed. Hopefully they'll get that shut down real quickly. And, Hetty, thank you very much. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you again.
And let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief fountain, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.